Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Daniel Foster, news editor at National Review Online, and for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We've got good news, bad news, and crazy news for conservatives today. And Dan, we don't often get too excited about votes we lose, but just this week, both in the Ryan budget, which presumes a repeal of Obamacare, which could potentially be wishful thinking, but it shows that the issue is still front and center in the minds of conservatives to deal with and eradicate if it can be possibly be done. And then as the Senate debated a continuing resolution to fund the government through the rest of the fiscal year, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, certainly one of our favorites, pushing forward a proposed amendment that would defund Obamacare for the rest of this fiscal year. Not surprisingly, in a Democratic Senate, it did not pass, but it shows not only that they're still willing to fight on this issue, I think it's a smart move because the majority of the American people still hate this thing.
Yeah, the bill, you know, kind of the popularity of Obamacare kind of oscillates around a little bit, but it's always on net unpopular usually when they poll it. A little while ago, we had a couple of NR guys who, Doug Holtz-Eakin and Ovik Roy, who wrote a piece in which they framed it as, this is our suggestion for reforming Obamacare. And the wonks on the left seized on it and said, ah, see, they're giving up. They're saying Obamacare is a fait accompli. It's here to stay. And now they're framing things in terms of reforming Obamacare. So I think we actually need a two-pronged approach. By the way, that piece is great, and I recommend all our listeners go read it. But I think we need a two-pronged approach. We need to, you know, keep up efforts exactly like this to, you know, remind everybody that this thing is not inevitable yet, that you can still dismantle it piece by piece, little by little, or wholesale. And you also need stuff like what Ryan's doing, which is that you're right, Ryan assumes the dismantling of Obamacare, but somewhat controversially, he also assumes that the revenue and spending levels set by Obamacare, or at least some of them, are part of the budgetary picture when he writes a budget. So you need to kind of have a plan A and a plan B, but you're absolutely right, at minimum for kind of morale reasons and symbolic reasons, you need to keep the fight alive so that if we do, say, take the Senate in 2014, you know, we can really amp up the pressure on the president.
And let's hope that happens. Defunding would obviously be extremely controversial if you think White House tours raises up the hackles. Defunding Obamacare would really get things fired up. But right now, politically, given the dynamics that are going on, it's pretty much all conservatives have from the House side anyway, because obviously we lost at the Supreme Court and we lost at the ballot box in 2012. So between that and people facing mountains of paperwork just to enroll now in health plans as a result of Obamacare, hopefully the momentum will somehow swing the right way.
I still think, by the way, that, you know, what you saw immediately after the passage of the bill, our listeners will know this, but you saw they peeled back some of the bigger revenue mechanisms, the IRS reporting thing where businesses were going to have to, you know, report expenses, you know, to a ridiculous level of specificity to collect more revenue. They, you know, repealed the long-term care piece of it for seniors. And you're starting to see little – and other stuff too. And you're starting to see little things get chipped away. And those are some of the big revenue drivers for Obamacare. So what you end up with in the end is a much, much more expensive piece of legislation. And it might just collapse of its own weight. Hopefully we won't have to go through that awful experience, that slow motion death of Obamacare that will involve a lot of people, as you put it, you know, dealing with mountains of paperwork, but also, you know, having a really bad healthcare experience. But that might be the way that Obamacare ends up going kaput, is of its own gravity.
On to martini number two now, the bad martini. We stay in the Senate. On the good side, Senate Democrats, thanks to some of the details passed in the pass a budget or don't get paid details or whatever, prompted the Senate Democrats to finally pass a budget for the first time since 2009. The bad news is pretty much what we thought. There's a lot more taxes in there, and it does not balance in 10 years or potentially ever, but $1 trillion in new taxes in there. So, Dan, more of the same, the quote-unquote balanced approach, which I'm sure is what the president is lecturing congressional Republicans up on the Hill about this week as well, but it's more of the same, and it doesn't look like they've got any new fresh ideas other than to pile on the debt and to pile on the taxes.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn. On the one hand, I really thought that politically the narrative of they haven't passed a budget or introduced one in over 1,000 days And I guess it got up to almost 1,400 or something like that. But I thought that that politically, that was a great narrative. It was almost, you know, they won't pass a budget. How mysterious and nefarious are the things that they'd actually want to do? How bad could it possibly be? You know, just what are they hiding? And that was a good narrative. But now they introduce this budget, and we realize, oh, they're just Democrats. They just want the same things that Democrats want higher taxes, more spending, not serious about entitlement reform, and only in the most abstract sense worried about deficit reduction. So you're right. You know, there's nothing really, I think, to work with here. Part of me thinks, just like with the Ryan budget, which some people are saying is more conservative than the last one, part of me thinks, you know, the hopeful part of me thinks maybe both of these budgets are the first step in a waltz, a compromise waltz, and there's going to be some big grand bargain that, you know, might be worth conservative supporting. But, you know, I learned a long time ago that that's probably wishful thinking. But that's, if you're looking for a bit of optimism in the bad martini, that's one way to think about it. These are, you know, the first step in a negotiating process, these budgets.
On to martini number three now, Dan, and the saga of the White House tours, which we mentioned a moment ago, never ceases to amaze us, and it's fun watching the White House kind of twist in the wind over this one. The president, in talking to George Stephanopoulos the other day, saying, oh, well, it wasn't my decision. The White House didn't make this decision. The Secret Service is the one who said they'd have to furlough workers. Congress is the one that couldn't, you know, come up with different ways to allot the sequestration cuts. And then Jay Carney, who's usually on message, even if in an awkward fashion, says on Wednesday, oh, no, the White House is in charge of the tours. We got information from the Secret Service that puts them in this situation, but we are the ones who have to make that decision. So president can't even keep his cover story right here.
Yeah, it's been a uniquely pathetic spectacle to watch the leader of the free world, as I put it, you know, in a blog post a few days ago, try desperately to find something that he had the authority to ruin and fail several times first. If you recall, he tried to ruin the lives of White House janitors, federal janitors. He failed to do that. He realized he didn't have the power to do that. You know, you had Arne Duncan going on the Sunday show trying to ruin the lives of teachers in West Virginia. He found out he didn't have the authority to do that. That sequester wasn't even going to do that. And so you had the president of the United States flailing in the wind, trying to find something he could cut, some pain he could cause, just to upset the American people and level some blame on Republicans for sequester. So finally, he gets something on the White House tours. He picks the pettiest, stupidest thing, and immediately everybody's all over him saying, oh, you couldn't maybe scale back your private chef, maybe put furlough him. You couldn't scale back the vacations. You got to go with the, you know, tours of the people's White House. So the pressure is, you know, it seems like it's now getting to the White House, and they're probably going to reverse course. We hope so. But it's just been really funny to watch him try and find something, you know, significant and yet small enough that he can actually wrap his hands around it to strangle it, you know, and blame it on the sequester. So it's been really quite amusing to watch. And I think every single claim that they made about the effects of the sequester, I'll give them credit. NBC, I believe, is keeping a rolling log, or MSNBC.com is keeping a rolling log of claims that, you know, White House made about sequester and fact checks, media fact checks about them. And I think they've gotten, you know, the old two or three Pinocchios about just about every one.
And I think that's what my favorite aspect of this is, that even the mainstream media has come to the conclusion that this is so ludicrous that they're heaping the criticism on, which is so rare. It's usually, you know, those of us in the blogosphere, talk radio, maybe Fox News, but pretty much everyone's piling on here just because they did overplay this so far. And, you know, hopefully that leads to actual scrutiny on more substantive policies as well, but I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah, don't get your hopes up.
Dan, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Daniel Foster is the news editor at National Review Online, and for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join Dan and me on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.